Yesterday morning, my wife went to get gas on the way to work, and she was one of the lucky ones. She got there just before they changed the sign. Yesterday morning, gas in the St. Louis area was the lowest in the country at $2.32.9. But while she was there, right after she made her purchase, they changed the sign to $2.59.9. It jumped up 27 cents in one day. What makes oil prices jump that much? And why are we still addicted to oil? And why is it so important in global geopolitics? All of this, part of what Peter Moss has written about in his book, Crude World, which is now out in paperback. The subtitle of Crude World is The Violent Twilight of Oil. Peter, welcome to the show. What do you mean by twilight in the title here?
What I mean by twilight is that the oil age began for us in earnest about a century ago, and there's at best, in terms of the most rosy estimates for the amount of oil that's left in the earth, 20 or 30 years in which oil can continue coming out of the ground in increasing amounts, and that's actually the most optimistic estimates there are. So if you look at 20 years as the perspective for increasing amounts of oil, and I think that's optimistic, versus 100 years in which it has been our central source of energy, then you're in the twilight period. You're close to the end.
And we continue to find ourselves, as I said, or as President Bush said several years ago, addicted to oil, and doesn't seem like anytime soon we're going to break from that addiction, although we must, right?
It's one of the kind of many distressing aspects of, for example, the BP accident in the Gulf of Mexico, that since that accident, which is the largest one, largest spillage of oil in recent American history, recent world history for that matter, actually the amount of gasoline consumed in America has continued to rise. So it hasn't had any effect. We remain, despite kind of the most egregious accident in our environmental history, very much addicted to it.
The thing that bothers me most about our oil situation is the way it affects our national policy, not just domestic policy when it comes to our oil consumption, but even our foreign policy. It incenses me the way we suck up to Saudi Arabia because of this black goo they have under their ground. How Iraq, the war was supposed to pay for itself because of all the oil in Iraq. But as you write in the book, many of these countries that have oil aren't really that wealthy, right?
This is what's known as the resource curse. And, you think, okay, you discover oil, it's like the Beverly Hillbillies. If you're a country, you've moved to Beverly Hills and live in a mansion. The paradox is that for a lot of the countries, not all of them, but for a lot of the countries that depend on oil for exports, they end up not richer but poorer as a result of oil. They end up not more peaceful but more violent. They end up not cleaner but dirtier as a result of oil. And so for them, it becomes a curse. And, you mentioned Saudi Arabia, you mentioned Iraq. You can go down the long list of oil countries. And what you'll find is that they have negative outcomes more often than they have positive outcomes.
So, for instance, in Saudi Arabia, they've got a high unemployment rate, which leads, of course, to more poverty, which, of course, leads to more people being sucked into terrorist activity, right?
Well, one of the ironies of oil, or problems of oil, is that even if you have a lot of it, and Saudi Arabia has a lot of it, is that the industry itself creates very few jobs. And so, for example, in Saudi Arabia, you have an unemployment problem, and this seems very strange. My gosh, these people, this country, they have all this oil. They have all this oil income coming in. But, even if you're as rich in oil as Saudi Arabia is, that doesn't mean that you have enough money to give everybody a job so that they can kind of show up at their office or whatever and earn a decent living and be happy with it. And that's a problem that exists in so many oil countries, is that they don't have enough jobs from the oil sector, and that on top of that, and this kind of gets into macroeconomic policy, the oil sector actually kind of drains activity and vibrancy out of other sectors, such as the farming, if there's a farming sector, or such as a manufacturing sector. So you end up having this kind of atrophied economy that has only one industry that creates money but doesn't create jobs. And jobs for most people are more important than whatever handouts the governments might be able to afford to give them.
So in those oil-rich nations, is it the people who are, or the companies that are involved in the oil business that are getting rich, but the people of the country itself not getting anything out of it?
It's a very unequal distribution. You know, you have, it depends on each country. You know, Saudi Arabia, of course, the royal family, which is quite large. I mean, we're talking about thousands and thousands of people, live very, very well. The ordinary people in Saudi Arabia live okay, but, you know, they're not terribly happy with their lot in life. You have a country like Nigeria where you had, in the 1990s, a military dictator who, when he died, was found to have had several $1 billion in foreign bank accounts. He was getting very rich. Ordinary Nigerians are still among the poorest in Africa, even though their country has been exporting large amounts of oil for about four decades.
Yeah, you say in the book that they're the eighth largest oil exporter in the world, and yet you got people who live on $2 a day or less.
And you've also got a war going on in the oil exporting part of Nigeria, the Niger Delta. It's kind of an off, on-again, off-again war in terms of local rebel militias against the government. It's kind of off at the moment, but could come back at any time. And the reason that it exists is because the people who live on top of the oil, forget about the entire country, which hasn't really benefited from it, but the people who live on top of the oil itself are actually the ones who have suffered the most. They've seen their wetlands, it's a big swamp area, be polluted beyond use so that they can't go fishing, so they can't farm anymore. And this has led, understandably, to a heck of a lot of grievance, which led, after peaceful demonstrations in the 1990s, which were crushed by the government, to a violent uprising.
In the book, we're talking with Peter Moss. His book is called Crude World, here on the Big 550 KTRS. In the book, you actually took time to go to and research some of these oil-rich nations. And most Americans, when they think of oil, they don't even know where our oil comes from. Far too many people think it all comes from the Middle East, and it doesn't. We get it from Venezuela and Mexico and Russia and Canada and African nations. And I didn't even know until I read the book about Equatorial Guinea. Talk a little bit about what the circumstances are in this country of about 600,000.
Equatorial Guinea, because it's so small, it's in West Africa, it was basically ignored by the world until about the mid-1990s when it discovered a large amount of oil offshore. Now, the country had been ruled for the last 30 years by Teodoro Obiang, its longtime president, who's regarded as kind of, in terms of human rights abuses, one of the worst in the world. So when all of a sudden oil was discovered in his waters, American oil companies were the ones that began extracting it. And all the money that they were paying, instead of going into government coffers and then being distributed to people, were actually going into bank accounts that were personally controlled by Obiang in America, actually, at Riggs Bank in America. So you had American companies paying money to this government, which was then just putting it into the president's bank account. And you had bank officials in America who were actually toting suitcases filled with cash from the embassy of Equatorial Guinea to the bank, Riggs Bank, in Washington, D.C., depositing it without asking any questions. And this has continued virtually kind of unstopped for a number of years. There was an investigation in Congress that revealed it. I went there to kind of find out what happened to all the money and what people there were thinking. And like kind of the very small number of journalists who are ever allowed to visit the country, after a week I was accused of being a spy and I was expelled.
Mm. And while you were there, you write in the book about a country that has very few doctors, doesn't have a lot of access to medicine, you know, billions of dollars that have flowed into and through this country, and yet the people of the country virtually untouched by that oil wealth.
There's a trickle down, and one has to kind of acknowledge, okay, in the last couple of years there's been a trickle down, you know, more roads, more public buildings, things of that sort. But it's a trickle-down that is, you know, way out of proportion to what should be quite a river, actually, of funding and improvement in the ordinary lives of people in Equatorial Guinea, economic improvement, but also political improvement. There just hasn't been the sort of political improvement that one would think. In the last election, which was in the last year, the president of Equatorial Guinea, a major U.S. ally, I think he got about, 97% of the vote, and he's not that good.
Not that good. He's a dictator who has no regard for human rights.
Well, precisely. And the Bush administration was very glad to invite Obiang to America and have him meet with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. But this has continued into the Obama administration. There's been really no let-up in kind of the goodwill between Washington and Equatorial Guinea. And it kind of points to, and this is one of the reasons I found this country so interesting, it points to kind of, you know, the fact that it's not one political party that is, let's say, particularly addicted to oil as a national security or as a monetary necessity for its own good. It's actually the political system of the United States, Democrat, Republican, as far as kind of American foreign policy relating to oil is concerned. There isn't a huge difference.
And so subsidizing dictators with no regard for human rights doesn't matter as long as somebody's making money.
you know, rhetoric changes, and there are small changes. I'd say perhaps it's a little bit better under the Obama administration, but fundamentally, no, because fundamentally, you know, American voters, American consumers do want to have gasoline. They want to have it as cheaply as they can, and they don't want to pay for or be told that they must pay for all of the changes and investments that would be necessary to begin to wean ourselves seriously from this addiction to oil. So it's pretty much giving the people what the people want.
Do you think that people's minds would be changed if they knew what was going on? Much of what you write about here in the book, I think, would come as an extreme shock to a lot of people, at least those who care about other people on this planet.
Well, you know, that's the reason that I wrote the book, is to try to make people aware that on the other side of the pipeline, there's a heck of a lot of really nasty stuff going on that's directly related to us, because we're the ones who need the oil. It's being extracted on our behalf. And, you know, I would hope that that would make a difference. You know, certainly when people learn that, you know, Nike tennis shoes are being made in sweatshop conditions in foreign countries, well, you know, Nike reacted, and there's a cleanup that goes on because of consumer pressure. The problem is that, you know, oil, gasoline, it's not a discretionary item. You know, people can go without Nike tennis shoes. They can't go without gasoline in their tanks. And so it's not as easy for consumers to react to this sort of information as it is for them to react about, you know, sweatshops that are providing garments for us. So, you know, in one sense, yes, I hope people react. In the other sense, I have to be realistic that these sorts of things, you know, have been produced before, have been written about before without dramatic changes. The one hope that I have, though, is that, you know, this kind of information combined with what your wife encountered at the gas station yesterday, which is rising prices, will have an effect. Prices are still relatively low right now, but as the U.S. economy, when the U.S. economy starts growing again and the world economy starts growing again and demand increases for gasoline, we're likely to see quite significant rises in the price of gasoline again. And one thing that Americans and all consumers are sensitive to is price. And so perhaps that's what's going to, in the end, get us off of oil quicker than otherwise might be the case, rising price of gasoline.
We've seen only in the last few years that when that first digit of the gas price becomes a 3, people, their eyebrows get raised and they start paying attention. And when it gets close to that first digit being a 4, that's when people start getting angry. And that's when change begins, at least a little bit. That's why we saw the move to more hybrids over the last couple of years and people talking about gas economy. All of that talk is gone now that the first digit's back to a 2.
Well, you know, one of the kind of solutions that a lot of people have talked about, of course, is a gasoline tax or a carbon tax of some sort. Now, obviously, for political reasons here in America, that's just really hard to imagine happening. You know, there's not going to be a gas tax on gasoline that will bring it up to, let's say, $4 a gallon so that consumers kind of begin to shift and that companies begin to shift in terms of what they provide with transportation alternatives. But, you know, when oil, gasoline, I should say, hit $4 a gallon in 2008, that was a real tipping point kind of moment, actually. You did see then people drive less, make different choices as to the cars that they drove. It was kind of a moment where you could see, like, okay, this is where the change begins to happen. And, you know, we're not at $4 a gallon right now, and I don't want to say that I'm hoping for $4 a gallon because it causes a heck of a lot of pain.
Yep.
But when we do reach that point, you know, if the government reacts appropriately in helping people who are having a tough time afford this, if the government reacts appropriately in advance of that moment by building the infrastructure for alternative forms of transportation, alternative forms of energy, then $4 a gallon won't hurt so much, and it will be kind of the point at which we begin to realize that change isn't so bad.
Well, we certainly couldn't handle those prices in this economy. People who are barely getting by paycheck to paycheck now can't afford to see the price of gas go up 50 to 75%.
The government has to be prepared to help people who are hurt the most by the high price of gasoline. And when we talk about prices determining behavior and when we talk about taxes, kind of, I think we all have to understand that we cannot have the pain of this fall just and mainly on the people who can least afford to suffer that pain.
It's the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris talking with Peter Moss, the author of Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. One country we haven't talked about here, which I think is going to loom much larger in any discussion of oil going forward, is China. A huge consumer, becoming a bigger consumer of this. Even if we try to wean ourselves from oil in the U.S., globally, the demand is going to keep going up, isn't it?
Well, you know, when I was in Equatorial Guinea before I got kicked out, I was staying at this hotel called the Dynasty Hotel, and it was only when I had to, you know, pay my bill at the last minute as I was expelled that I kind of realized what was going on, because I was told, well, you can pay your bill in cash, or you can have the balance paid into our bank account. And I asked, where's the bank account? And they told me it's in Hong Kong. And I kind of realized, aha, you know, that's why there's Chinese food being served in the restaurant, this hotel. The hotel, the Dynasty Hotel, I should have figured it out much sooner, was owned by a Chinese company. And you know, there had been, I had noticed that there were some roads that were being built, and it was actually Chinese laborers who were building the road. This is, you know, in the heart of Africa. And this points to the need that China has for resources, and it's not just oil. It's a heck of a lot of other resources. And so, you know, this is part of you know, there's so many ways in which this is a new geopolitical game, because it's not just kind of the climate problem in the sense of this means that there's going to be a heck of a lot more in the way of carbon emitted into the atmosphere by all these Chinese consumers. It also means that all over the globe you have Chinese companies competing against other companies. And in the past, there weren't Chinese companies doing it. And it, you know, it is the Chinese people's rights. I mean, why do we in America have more rights to Africa's resources than the Chinese people do? It just makes for a much more complicated and potentially volatile situation if we don't figure it out.
And if we walk this back to our discussion of human rights, that's certainly a country that doesn't care about human rights, because they're such a violator of human rights themselves.
You know, this is another layer of the problem, which is that, you know, one of the arguments for American corporate presences in all these countries is that, look, you know, American companies, you may have your problems with their records on human rights or whatever, or on corruption or bribery or whatever, but they're a lot better than the Chinese companies. You know, government officials are more likely to be able to get money out of Chinese companies in a backhanded way than from American companies. And that is true, but I don't think that to me, it's just not persuasive as an argument for kind of beating back the Chinese, because it's been shown that, you know, American companies, with the backing of the American government, have been involved in a heck of a lot of corruption and continue to be. So our hands are not entirely clean, so it's kind of a little bit hypocritical for us to say, look at the dirty Chinese hands all over the globe, now we must do something about it.
Peter, when you talked to some of the CEOs of these oil companies, do they care about any of this, or is it just bottom line?
Well, I would say it's just bottom line, but I wouldn't say that in the context of, you know, these oil executives are different from other executives. I mean, business is business, and business is fundamentally, when you get down to it, about the bottom line, whether you're Exxon, whether you're Google. And for that matter, you know, when I talked to this one executive who actually had been convicted of tax evasion, and had spent 2 years in jail. This is an American. And I asked him about all these kinds of problems and the bad things that he had allegedly been involved in, had pled guilty to, and that other executives had been involved in, other companies. He kind of stopped. We were having lunch. He said, look, he said, if all you want us to do is drill for oil in London and Paris, because the regulatory environments are very good and the governments are democratic, okay, that's all we'll do. But then you're going to be stepping over manure in the streets of New York City, because we're going to be riding around on horses. So I don't think, therefore, that we can blame these executives and say that they are the problem. I think, you know, they are conduits for a resource that we desire, and we desire it from places where business is done in a not terribly clean way.
Well, when you talk to them, obviously they have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders and to their companies. But when greed gets in the way of safety, as I think it did with BP, then we're talking about something completely different. When you talk about BP and the oil spill in the Gulf, we're going to probably see more stories about safety and more violations, and they certainly have been fined multiple times. Is there any thing in the corporate suite that says, oh, you know what, we've done something wrong here, and we've got to fix it?
Well, you know what companies do respond to is laws that they must follow. You know, I think the problem of what happened in the Gulf of Mexico, and this has happened in lots of other places, BP is not the only company that has had these kinds of safety problems.
Right.
You know, the real problem is that there are laws that companies can get around. And if it pays for them to get around them, then they will, because, again, it's the bottom line. I don't think it's the individual greed of the fellow who is, you know, in charge of offshore or onshore operations of that particular rig. I mean, these people have jobs to do. They have to get the oil out as quickly as possible, you know, without a major disaster. And so they'll cut corners because they're worried about their jobs. And I think, you know, you can't kind of leave it up to you know, human emotions and human goodwill for the right thing to be done. I mean, you have to have laws that are vigorously enforced. I just don't think that you can expect an oilman or a computer executive or any other company to do the right thing just because it's coming from the goodness of his or her heart. It's not even in some respects in there an option for them to choose, okay, the good thing versus the profitable thing, because if they don't do the profitable thing, as much as they might like to do the good thing, they could lose their job.
So are you laying the blame with the impotence of people like those at the Minerals and Mining Service and other federal agencies that were supposed to be cracking down on these companies and doing more oversight?
Well, yes and no, because I think that, you know, the what was going on at the Mineral Mining Service, which, of course, is in charge of implementing the regulations and laws of oil extraction in the Gulf of Mexico and elsewhere in America, you know, they were asleep at the switch. But why were they asleep at the switch? Well, they were asleep at the switch because the folks above them, you know, in Congress, in the White House, didn't want them to be awake at the switch because they weren't given, you know, enough manpower. They weren't given enough incentive. They weren't told, hey, go out there, vigorously enforce these rules, even if it means that it'll take longer to extract oil in the Gulf of Mexico. So I think it's right, you know, to punish, to discipline the officials who were not doing their jobs at the MMS. But then I think one also needs to understand, why weren't they doing their jobs? And they weren't doing their jobs because nobody higher up wanted them to do their job. So I think you have to return to, okay, what is the policy, the direction that's being set at the highest levels of the U.S. government? And then you have to ask, why are those policies being set? It's because actually they do have some popular support in America. So, you know, what needs to happen is kind of a come-to-Jesus sort of moment where we don't just point fingers at the individual violators in the system, that we kind of understand that we have a system that is problematic and we need to change that system.
The book is called Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. There's a lot of stuff in here that I did not know was going on, particularly when it came to some of these so-called oil-rich nations. And Peter actually went there and did some first-hand reporting on them before the country said, you can't do that here. Leave. It's fascinating because he talks to people at pretty much every level of the oil industry, and it's a great read. Thanks for your time today, Peter. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. Peter Moss here on The McGraw Show with Paul Harris on the Big 550 KTRS.